Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're going to be talking with someone who is very well known in the city of Racine for the really good work that he has done on behalf of his community over the course of decades, including a career in public service in Racine that included a stint as community director. He was, by the way, the first Black to ever be selected to that post. For many years, director of the administrator of Parks, Recreation, and Cultural Services. And again, the first time that the city of Racine put a Black man in that particular position. And Chuck Tyler's really interesting life and career is explored in a memoir that he has written called Youth in the Center of My Heart, in which he spells out a lot of what he has experienced, a lot of what he has tried to do in his community and for young people and for his family, the lessons he's learned from the people who were valuable mentors for him, the role that his religious faith has played in inspiring him to live the life that he has. And we are going to spend a few minutes at the start of today's morning show talking with Chuck Tyler about this life he's led and about this book, which again is titled Youth in the Center of My Heart. Chuck Tyler, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you very much, Greg. It's a pleasure being here.
Glad you are here. And I want to mention also that your good friend Jim Wardrop initially made this suggestion to me, and your book, Youth in the Center of My Heart, is on sale at the Racine Heritage Museum, where he is so active. It's great to have you here.
Well, thank you.
Ahead of asking you some specifics about your life, could you say a word about this intriguing title, Youth in the Center of My Heart? Explain why the book is titled that.
Well, Greg, I've always been around young people since my father was in my life. And young people are just in my heart. And that title just jumped out at me, Youth in the Center of My Heart.
Mm. So in other words, you have this sort of burning
call
to to make a difference for the better in the lives of young people, and certainly have done that in really exciting ways. Let's talk about your own childhood. You were actually, although everyone thinks of you as sort of inextricably linked to Racine, in fact, you were born and I believe raised in the community of Cairo, Illinois.
That's right.
Spelled
right.
Like Cairo, right. Egypt, but down there they say Cairo.
Cairo,
Illinois. Explain what those years in Cairo was like. You speak actually very affectionately about that community in your book.
Yeah, well, thank you, Greg. Yeah, matter of fact, let me just take you back briefly when I was 5 years old. And that's when my mother passed away. And she was very strong in my life. And what I did, I got on my knees and I prayed that that I lost my mother, and I asked God to make my father my rock. And not only did he make my father my rock for many years, but he gave me a vision. And I've been living on vision since childhood. My father's my rock, and my vision that got me to where I am today. Hmm. That's kind of like, to sum it up, that's my...
shaped a lot of things.
It did.
So that also helps explain why your relationship with your dad was so really powerful, because he was the only parent you experienced for most of your childhood then.
Right. When my mother passed away, my aunt Ella raised me. However, my dad was my rock, because he was able to get me to envision the consequence of my action. In other words, he would say that if you do something, you know, stupid, then you're going to pay the consequences. So he's always able to get me to envision, you know, where my buddies would get in trouble. You know, I was able to envision, you know, the do's and don'ts of not getting in trouble. Hmm. And then one day I asked him, I said, Dad, why didn't you ever spank me? And he said, I didn't have to, because I got you to envision the consequences of your action.
Thinking beyond just the moment,
exactly,
and the impulse.
Right. But he was a wise man, but he was able to collaborate with other people. In my hometown, it was very tight-knit, you know, so it was okay for the teachers and other people to spank me, but he never had to.
Mm. You make mention in your book about a place that was very special to you and also seems to have had some hand in the raising of you, if you will, a place called The Grill.
That's right.
And was it Mr. Booker who was behind
Mr. Booker.
Yeah. So tell us why The Grill mattered in your life.
Well, The Grill and Carroll, we didn't have too many places to go, either school or a playground or The Grill. And The Grill was an old, dilapidated building about to fall down. And Mr. Booker would let us come there and hang out, listen to the jukebox, play the pinball machine. And he became my mentor. In other words, he had the patience of Job. Hmm. If we drove him nuts at times and you know, insane, he would be able to point out, you know, to us the do's and don'ts. And he never kicked us out. Matter of fact, he sacrificed his business for us. You know, we took up room that he could have had for his customers.
Mm.
So he became an important person in my life. Matter of fact, he probably influenced me, inspired me to become a community center director. In other words, I picked up a lot of his ways.
Right. So in other words, some of the community centers you helped create in Racine,
right,
in some ways bear at least a little bit of resemblance to what happened at The Grill in Cairo.
It did, because when I oversaw community centers, so I came here in 1966, and it was another dilapidated building that the city thought about tearing down, but a priest by the name of Father Labai saw something in me, and he got the city to realize, let's give this young man a chance to program. And there were moments when we would have sometimes 300 to 400 young people there, but my key to programming was to get to know young people one-on-one. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time with them one-on-one, and I felt like that if they loved me, then they would allow me to discipline them, and by being able to discipline them, I was able to guide them. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was my saving grace.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about your dad's own really impressive athletic ability. He had some talents that were really significant, I think, especially in baseball, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
Talents, unfortunately, that he didn't really have the opportunity to sort of fully explore. First of all, tell us, how good a baseball player was he? And in a sense, how did his experience, both the glory and the disappointments, kind of help shape you?
Well, first of all, Greg, my dad wanted me to play baseball. He saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. I was a natural hitter, and he would toss me the ball, and I just hit it, and I swung from the left side. And he loved baseball. Matter of fact, he knew every baseball player by name. He has such a terrific arm. He could be out in deep center field and throw a strike across home plate. That's how good he was.
Hmm.
He was quick, but he didn't have the opportunity to you know, to show the world his talent. You know, so he among the people in Curo, they realized how good he was. But my dad, based on what I saw and what I believe, he could have been in the major league, and he could have played among the best. You know, he was my Babe Ruth in my life. And he was just natural. And he, as a matter of fact, not only was he natural in baseball, he was natural in basketball, track, football. He wanted me to play football, and I didn't have a desire to play football. And he would tease me and say, "Oh, you big sissy." And I said, "No, Dad, I just don't want to play football. But I wanted to, you know, see myself for basketball." That was my natural talent.
Right. It sounds like that was something which you had some tremendous ability. What was it especially about basketball that you loved so much and continue to love to this day?
It was just a call. It was my natural talent. When I was in elementary school, I loved basketball. In those days, we didn't have a community center really to go to except for the grill. And we spent our time outside playing. Matter of fact, I made my own basketball goal out of a bucket, you know, knocked out to the bottom of it. I couldn't afford a basketball. Oftentimes, I would dribble a balloon up and down. And I would spend hours just dribbling basketball. And basketball became my saving grace. It was able to take me to another level in my life, and I was good at it. Matter of fact, when I graduated from high school, I didn't know where I was going, and I decided to join the Navy, and I went over to Japan, and I was able to play basketball over there, and from there I received a scholarship, and there I went on to play basketball in South Dakota. But my basketball kept me out of trouble. You know, if people around me, my friends, were getting in trouble, but I would always focus on basketball, you know, for hours and hours, and it led me to where I'm at today.
Right. You said that you had actually, for a while there, aspired to be a teacher and a coach.
Right.
How is it that you, in fact, ended up on kind of a different professional track? How did that happen?
Well, I just wanted to, you know, just a teaching coach. That's what I, you know, wanted to do. However, when I graduated from here in South Dakota, I found out that I didn't really want to teach like I thought, but I wanted to coach, you know. And then God brought a community center into my life. What I mean by that is that I started working at GI Case for about 6 months, and that wasn't what I felt was my call. Ended up going to the Boys Club for a year, and then after Boys Club for a year, I was able to get a job with the City of Racine in 1966 as a community center director. And I realized that was my call. You know, that was it. Teaching, you know, I love that too, but being around young people.
And in a sense, you're maybe not in a classroom, but I'm sure there was a whole lot of teaching that was actually involved in that work in community centers.
Right.
You tell us in the book that Racine built its first community center in 1929.
Right.
And you think these community centers have made a huge difference in the lives of a lot of young people. For the sake of listeners who've never been through the door of a community center in a city like Racine, what does one find there, and what happens in these community centers?
Well, a community center, to me, and I think nowadays, it's like a place away from home for young people. In the 60s and 70s, I had a reputation where I didn't kick anybody out of a community center. I felt once they were there, they were mine to do all I could to inspire and to save. And nowadays, I believe the community centers feel the same way. You know, young people come there where they feel at home, and they give the directors and people who work there an opportunity to inspire them, to listen to them, and to hopefully direct them in the right direction. It's amazing what listening can do. And oftentimes I spent hours and hours listening to young people. Once I listened to find out their needs, then I was able to direct them and guide them. But the key to young people coming to a community center is the trust. I think there's a lot of trust in community centers. And once they trust you, they usually let their guards down and explain what's going on, and you're able to guide them in the right direction.
Hmm. How do you build that sense of trust? I mean, is there anything in particular you feel like you would do or you would say so these young people would trust you in the way you just described?
Well, you know what it is? It's a spirit. Young people feel your spirit. You know, they know, all of them. And once they feel you out and feel your spirit, that draws them to you. You know, and if you go in there just to, for the sake of a job, then you're not going to draw young people like that. Hmm. Matter of fact, if I can deviate just briefly, community centers have a track record of producing outstanding people, celebrities, and they have an outstanding track record for intervention and prevention, for keeping young people to being locked up. And I can think of two people in particular, Jim Jones, who came up through a community center. And he became who he, you know, became a great basketball player. And the same thing with Caron Butler. He came up through a community center where the end results, you know, it was part of him being where he is today. You know, and the story, we have countless stories like that. And some go off to get their education. Some go off to the entertainment world, you know. But most of all, we try to save them or keep them from being locked up. That's another reason why I wrote the book. I hate seeing people locked up, young people locked up. So I do everything I can before they, you know, they're locked up. Then they realize, once they're locked up, sometimes they realize they had it made.
Right.
So we try to, we try to inspire them, to get them to envision the consequence of their action.
In the same way that your father instilled that so well in you.
That's right, yeah.
We should mention that one of Racine's community centers is actually named after you, and I think after one of your predecessors in the job, Al Doman.
Yes.
Which community center is named after you?
It was used to be called the Lafayette Community Center, adjacent to Park High School, and then that was an old swimming pool. And that's a center that was named after me, the Tyler Domer Center, and I'm so honored by that because Mr. Domer, who was our overseer and the director of Parks, Recreation, and Cultural Service Department. When you get involved in struggling for new community centers, which we did, we were able to get two new ones plus one renovated, you know, sometimes the politics get very, very heavy. And Mr. Domer was my more or less saving grace because there were times I was out there and he was able to justify and, you know, and defend me why I was doing what I was doing. And I have the utmost love and respect for that. But the community centers, getting back to that, it was such an honor to have one named after me. Matter of fact, my father was able to live to be around to see that because then I gave him so much credit for me having something named after me.
Right. I said specifically that you were the first black community director and the first black administrator of parks for Racine because it says that right on the back of your book, so that's obviously something you don't mind people saying. But I'm just curious, at the time, was that important to you or was it important to the Racine? I mean, to the city of Racine, do you think that was, in a sense, a significant gesture on the part of the leaders of Racine to put a black man into these positions of leadership? And what kind of responsibility did you feel?
Well, first of all, I didn't want to become the director. I just wanted to be with young people.
Hmm.
And my good friend Bob Turner and my wife inspired me to take on that responsibility because I didn't want to just get involved in the politics. I went in there to be with young people, but things happened along the way. I kept getting promoted. You know, I didn't go there to get promoted. You know, I went in there to be with young people and be a public servant. You know, and things happened. You know, I ended up becoming director of the department, but it was not by plan or my desire. You know, I just want to be with young people, basically, and keep them out of jail and inspire them and to get them to realize their God-given talent. You know, that's the key to young people because oftentimes they're bored. If you can get them to realize that they were created with a God-given talent, You know, that's when you have the love and joy of life, no matter what it is, carpentry, janitor, whatever. You know, and that's what I spend a lot of time one-on-one inspiring them in that direction.
You have been retired since 1999, but I suspect it's a retirement in which you haven't done a lot of sitting around.
No, it's a spiritual calling. You know, it's a calling that you can't even explain. And as long as I have that desire and that call, then I'll do it until eternity. But right now, you know, I just, my vision tells me, keep going.
Mm.
You know, and plus there's one more book I want to write, too. You know, I'm not through with writing yet.
There you go.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, you also are busy spoiling 8 grandchildren and 4 great-grandchildren.
Oh, I found out 6. I made a mistake. 6 great ones.
6 great-grandchildren, yeah, right. 8 grandchildren. And they are, of course, really, really fortunate to have someone like you in their lives, just like Racine is so fortunate, and the young people who live here. We want to remind people that your book, Youth in the Center of My Heart, can be purchased at the Racine Heritage Museum.
Yes.
And there is a lot packed into this book about the life of Chuck Tyler, what is most important to him. And it is a very special story indeed. Chuck Tyler, I've really enjoyed this opportunity to speak with you about your life story and about your book. And we certainly wish you well in all of the years that are ahead of you. And we hope that you will continue to do the great work that you've already done for such a long time on behalf of young people in Racine.
Well, thank you very, very much, Greg. It's a pleasure being here, and thank you again.
You're very, very welcome. Here's part 2 of today's morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. We have all certainly been on the receiving end of hurtful words, and if anything, we are experiencing that even more, given the times in which we live, divisive times, of course, for our country. And it seems that often when people are talking about maybe difficult topics or for whatever reason, we seem to be especially good at lashing out with words that can cut very deeply and inflict a lot of pain. And sometimes, of course, it doesn't need to be a political squabble or anything around sort of momentous, weighty issues. Sometimes it is over personal slights or something that emerges out of a misunderstanding that can lead to really unfortunate, painful things being said. What do we do when somebody has spoken to us or about us in a way that causes us pain? How do we move beyond it? Janelle Reardon has written a book on this topic called Overcoming Hurtful Words, Rewrite Your Own Story. She is a speaker and author and relationship expert and life coach from a Christian perspective, as a matter of fact. And in this book, she seeks to give us some strategies that can help help somebody move beyond what has maybe been a very, very painful, hurtful exchange. And we're going to be speaking with her for the next few minutes about her work and about this book again called Overcoming Hurtful Words, which is published by Worthy Inspired. Janelle Reardon, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you, Greg. It is an honor to be on your show.
I'm glad we can have this this conversation. What, if anything in particular, prompted you to explore this particular topic to such length?
Very personal, obviously. It was first and foremost to dig into this whole emotional, relational trauma subject. There was a tipping point with a female leader, but it really was a tipping point, Greg. As I reflected back, I come from the home of an alcoholic father. My husband does as well. And so there was certainly a lifelong history within my own personal family of origins of hurtful words and actions from people that, you know, are supposed to be your safe people. And so I think that it's really been an ongoing process in my life. I can reflect back to being, you know, 6, 7, 10 years old and going, there's just something not quite right here. So I think I've been, I was born into the world very sensitive, very intuitive, very empathic. So I think it has truly been a lifelong journey of understanding the power of our words. Hmm. Words have always been very, very important to me. Maybe that's just what my whole entire purpose in life, as I look back now over, you know, half a century. So I think it became for me a lifelong process that then hit a tipping point where I just, boy, it was an emotional, traumatic crisis. And I thought, I can't live this way anymore. I need to make some changes, and change begins within my own heart. Hmm. And so as a teacher, as a counselor, I began to research, and that's what I did.
Hmm.
And it led me to this new program, this new, whole new platform on which I will stand till the day I die.
Hmm. A couple things I want to ask you of kind of overarching fashion. Mm-hmm. One of them is, and I think it's important to say this, that because this is a public radio station, it's actually not often that that I deal with books that are quite explicitly sort of Christian in their focus, although I happen to be a Christian and my Christian faith is very important to me, but that's typically not what this program can or really should be about. However, in this case, I really felt like this was a book that had some very important things to say, potentially even to somebody who maybe comes from a different faith tradition or potentially even without any faith tradition whatsoever. But I think you are talking about something very, very important and something that potentially could make a difference, whether or not somebody happens to have the same background of faith that you do. I'm just curious if you thought about that at all as you wrote this book, hoping that it would not only be a helpful book for your own fellow believers, but would even have something to offer somebody else.
Oh, you just hit the nail on the head, Greg. It was actually a tension, my whole process of writing, because it really is a topic that extends the realm of what we would call organized religion. It is a tenet in living a meaningful life, a rich, rewarding life. It's a book that deals with civility and integrity and reaches beyond the realm of faith. I just so happen to adhere to the Judeo-Christian worldview. So, it, you know, I do speak of God. I talk about Jesus, and I see that as an ancient text that I adhere to and I believe in wholeheartedly. But the subject, as in my practice, my private practice, totally speaks to every human being at the core level. So it definitely reaches beyond the faith realm, and I sure pray that it does.
Mm.
Because not only does our nation need this message, the world needs this message.
Right.
We have somewhere forgotten the practice of discretion, the practice of civility, the practice of just being empathic human beings.
Right. I quite agree. You also, at some point early on in the book, make mention of how a lot of this book springs not only out of your own understanding and experience, but also from having spoken with many, many women. And the thing I want to ask you about is that matter of women versus men. And to what extent this book really is written for women and about women, or is this something in which you think women experience this in a way different from the way men experience this? Help us understand that divide, particularly in terms of what you were thinking, how you framed this in your own mind as you wrote this book. Is this a book, in a sense, only for women?
No. I will definitely explain my tenet for this. In my private practice, in not only my private practice, but then in my speaking and lecturing, and it tended to be women waiting around to talk, women standing in line. In my practice working with marital couples, it ended up totally being the woman was more the heartbeat, the heart, bearing the burden for the family, in the sense that we are typically the more emotional, more sensitive, more empathic, not on the whole, but typically. And so for the purpose of this book, I felt like I think the woman truly is the heart of the home. And, you know, the old adage that the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world, right? We are the child bearers. We are the ones that create that initial deep, intimate bond with children in the womb. So it does come, I'm a woman, it comes from that perspective, speaking to the heart of a woman. But, and women truly are the readers, you know, statistically in the family. And so it is definitely not just for women. And maybe we can expand this as we move into the next book and the next book. I totally would love to have a family book and a whole family curriculum on how to do this as a family. But, yeah, so Ernest's answer is just narrow the focus of this particular book to speak to the woman, and then hopefully it'll go and expand from there.
Right. You talk in the book about some terms that I'm pretty sure you have coined that mm-hmm. all relate to the word heart, the human heart. And in particular, you talk about the heart rift and the heart sift and the heart lift, the heart and the heart shift. And it's
a
very
lot of heart.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to think about all of that. Of course, all of this really begins with when someone has suffered what you call a heart rift. Explain typically how a heart rift is sort of suffered, or how a heart rift is inflicted on someone, and what it typically feels like.
Typically feels like an emotional earthquake. I write in Overcoming Hurtful Words how here in Virginia we, one August afternoon, experienced an earthquake. Now that's the East Coast. We don't experience earthquakes here. And it was about, the epicenter was about 150 miles from my home. And, you know, it just rattles and shakes everything. So kind of working on that metaphor of earthquake physically, that emotionally we experience an earthquake when someone delivers shocking, harmful, hurtful, you know, often emotionally paralyzing words. We experience that deep layer within our heart where it causes a rift, you know, a little fracture. And for some of us, that starts early in our life, and then, you know, the rift just gets to a point where, you know, it just can't take anymore. So a heart rift is that first stage of the heartless method that you move through in the book. And it's just those deep wounds that are caused by those heartbreaking words. And typically, they're deeper when they come from a close, trusted friend or family member.
Right. I was just going to say,
yeah,
that the strangers can certainly inflict pain, but it is not the same as when
no.
somebody you love and trust has delivered.
Oh, those people. Yeah.
So
yeah, it's really the same experience I felt sitting in my living room. I was actually taping a video series from my very first book in 2007, Rock Solid Families. I was taping a video series and an earthquake happened. So all of the book, Rock Solid, the tape, everything fell off the counter, and I was like, oh, my goodness. It comes that swiftly. Like, what just happened, you know?
Hmm.
And that's what first days reflect, what just happened. What on earth is going on here?
Right. And I suppose that's part of when we talk about the what you like to call the heart sift, where we take the time to kind of examine something, but in a way that is healthy.
This is all about the premise of this entire, hopefully this whole new movement that I'm hoping to start, is healthy and unhealthy. We really only have two choices of responding in life. Unhealthy is a reaction, healthy is a response. So yes, the heart shift, and I know you're moving into heart lift, but the heart sift part is just really where you sit and examine in a healthy way, perhaps with a counselor, a trained life coach. I'm hoping to raise up an army of heart lifters where you examine those risks just long enough in a healthy way and vocalize that crushing pain so that you can put it to rest, you can make peace with it, so that you can move into future freedom. So it is a methodical, heartfelt approach where just like you would sift flour, you're just going to go, okay, this happened to me. That's a marker on my life map. Now what do I do with it?
I think one of the things that's interesting about this bit of advice is that I think what is sometimes assumed by people is that the best thing somebody can do is try to put something behind them, try to forget about it. And sometimes they are advised to do that, and sometimes it's something we ourselves feel like we should do because confronting something, thinking about something that has caused us great hurt is often something that causes us, at least in the short term, a great deal of discomfort. But you are saying that this is a process that we simply cannot afford to avoid.
If, in fact, you want to move into true freedom. You know, I with my clients and in my own personal life, I see people stop just short of the finish line, right? It just gets to be too hard, too much work, and they stop. And so when that happens, you really stay stuck. I write, and in the next book, I hate to go to that one, but I'm writing a lot more about the let it go thing. But, you know, really, Greg, do you want to be whole, truly whole? And if, in fact, you do, then it's vital that you examine your history of hurts, is what I call it, with a healthy perspective so that you can move on. Now, obviously, there are deeper wounds than others. You know, and that's, I'm not saying that you're just going to move right along. It is going to be a process. I say over and over, this is not easy, but it's empowering, and I will walk with you through this. So we don't want to stop just short of the emotional freedom finish line. We want to do the work, and that's why we need a community around us of support that will help us move beyond and forward.
Could you say a word, please, about the three phases of what you call this heart lift journey of coming to terms with a hurt that we have experienced, the three phases of reflect, reframe, and reauthor?
Yes. So being a methodical person, I'm a very nuts and bolts human being and counselor and life coach. So I have always been the person who wants my clients to leave with a plan of action. So for me, it was like, okay, a heart lift is just the safe space where we vocalize our crushing pain, which is our history of hurts. We look at it long enough to deal and to look at the unhealthy in order to move forward into future freedom. So we do that in three phases. Reflect, as you said, is the heart rifting phase. We go, that's where the earthquake happens, and you go, holy cow, you're holding on to your chair. What just happened? And in my vernacular, my Judeo-Christian, I say, welcome God into the present pain. You know, that's the present pain. That hurts so bad. Oh, my goodness, what happened? All right, let's say outside the realm of faith, we can just say, welcome breath into that. Because breathing just means to gain composure. So I turn to God, I gain my composure there. Now that's that Viktor Frankl says, between the stimulus and the response, there's a space. And that's a millisecond usually. So, you know, a big initiative of this book is to train, you know, emotional health first responders, you know, so that we can go, okay, we're going to practice, and we're going to train everyone in our community to practice so that when these hurtful words happen, we know how to handle it. We move from what just happened to the reframe, which is the heart shift. That's where the heart goes, oh, and it awakens to truth. And this, in this reframing, you face the fault lines. You face those fault lines that have been shifting for years, those past hurts. And then with the help of your community or a healthy mentor or counselor or relational coach or trauma coach, you reauthor. It is a proven statistic, Greg, that when you make sense of your story, you can move into freedom. Just making sense of it. Just going, okay, let me look at this and let me just wrap my brain around growing up for me in an alcoholic home and the repercussions of that so that I do not have to stay labeled as codependent or ACOA, et cetera, you fill in the blanks of your life, so that I can move into a meaningful, healthy life. So those three phases, that's how we move through it. And honestly, it leads to tremendous, tremendous freedom.
Hmm. In building what at one point you call a new narrative that one builds for one's life.
Yeah.
In our last minute or two, I wanted you to at least touch
on
time flies as I wanted you to just touch briefly on something that you share in the book about a health crisis that you yourself experienced involving a condition I'd never heard of, but one that can affect the way someone swallows. So something as essential to life as that. It's intriguing that this is included in your book, but I'm glad that it's there. It's a very poignant part of your own personal story. Just at least touch on what I am talking about and explain how this experience has been important for you and important for your own journey.
Well, a very short story of a very long journey. I began to have cardiac feelings as though I was having a heart attack and evolved into not being able to swallow. I couldn't even swallow water. So went through a battery of very long testing until I finally went to an expert GI doctor who put me through a test and found out I have this rare disease, esophageal disease called achalasia. It actually means failure to relax, which is kind of funny for a type A girl, but I couldn't swallow. And so I remember sitting in the office when he said, you have achalasia, write that down in that little notebook of yours. And by the end of this ordeal, Janelle, you are going to be an expert in swallowing. And I thought it was very interesting. So as I was going through the book, it wasn't my intention, but then when I got to looking up the word swallow, I saw that it meant one of the meanings is to suppress feelings. Well, I about fell off my chair. And when you look at it further, it can actually mean to resist something consciously. And behavioral scientists have come to see that repressors are people, you know, like myself, honestly. So the physical definitely related to my emotional state where I maintain a stiff upper lip under all circumstances. And they say that we're one of the most mystifying personality types. So people would always say, oh, Janelle, you're so strong, strong, strong. You're just the strongest person. Well, no, that's when I finally came to the end of my strength is where I really became, a new person and began to write my new narrative because I couldn't physically swallow. I had to have an experimental surgery, the third in the state of Virginia, where they just cut open your lower sphincter, so now it's just open all the time. So, Greg, for me, it just paralleled, and I felt like it was so very, very important because a lot of times when we suppress, we deny, we don't use our voice to respond in a healthy manner to this unhealthiness emotionally that's going on around us, that suppression is going to take a toll. And I see it happening every day. So if I can do anything through this book, through my time on this platform, this beautiful opportunity that I have been given, I hope to help people find their voice, and voice equates to me with value, worth, and dignity, so that when they are spoken to in a way that lacks discretion or unhealthiness, they can respond in a healthy manner. That's the whole, my whole purpose. And so now I have a physical disease that constantly reminds me of this great emotional need that I see around me.
I like that very much. I don't like that you are dealing with this affliction, but I appreciate the fact in which you have, in a made sense of it, and in a sense made it a teachable moment for yourself, and of course for all of us as well. The book again is
we
Overcoming.
We have to do that, don't we?
Yes, absolutely. That's part of what it's all about. The book again is
Turn it around.
Yes, the book is Overcoming Hurtful Words. Rewrite Your Own Story, published by Worthy Inspired and the author, Janelle Reardon. Janelle Reardon, I have very much enjoyed this, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak with you about your very, very interesting book. Very best wishes to you, and thank you for your time.
You too, Greg. Blessings.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a couple of different interviews, including one with author Barbara Kahn, who is the author of The Shopping Revolution, How Successful Retailers Win Customers in an Era of Endless Disruption. It's certainly not anything new in terms of news that many retailers are struggling in our new economy, and certain famous big box stores are closing, malls are struggling, at least in certain locations. Barbara Kahn helps to kind of untangle the situation and helps us understand which retailers are struggling and why, and which retailers continue to flourish, and what is behind their continued success. You'll hear her insights in tomorrow's morning show. On Friday, I'll be speaking with Xue Kwok, who is a Vietnamese-American and the author of Calm Clarity, How to Use Science to Rewire Your Brain for Greater Wisdom, Fulfillment, and Joy. Xue Kwok has had to deal with what amounts to a form of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, in the wake of the trauma which she and her family experienced in leaving war-torn Vietnam. And she came to an understanding of how she could find much greater serenity and health in her life, and has written about this in this book called Calm Clarity. We want to also tell you about one or two interesting morning shows coming up next week. On Monday, you'll hear the conversation which I just recorded with C.N. Lester, a book called Trans Like Me, Conversations for All of Us. In this book, C.N. Lester talks about the struggles of coming to grips with gender and whether or not one is male or female within that strict binary, or if, in fact, gender is something that is a bit more on a continuum. C.N. Lester has worked very tirelessly on behalf of trans individuals in her native Great Britain, and in fact founded one of the first organizations designed specifically to offer support and resources to young people who are trans. It's a really, really fascinating book, and we had a lengthy conversation that I think explored a number of very, very interesting areas. So that will be Monday the 18th, my conversation with C.N. Lester, the author of a already